Yeah, honorable members, good morning and welcome back. I know Monday, so if we had left some of the things for the other days, we were going to be really overcrowded with work. So thank you for your cooperation and understanding. And welcome back after, I would say, a very busy, interesting, challenging, and political life full of activity out there. And a lot of things I must use your mic to say those words. we also recognize that we also, as people involved with the economy of our country, the issues out there are also, we also live during very trying times. The world itself is upside down, and, you know, it remains to be seen how resilient our economy is going to be. And, you know, they say it's very difficult to be completely insulated from problems like these. The only time you are insulated is when you are isolated. So, and I think it calls for very cool heads for us to be able to move on during these times. We had agreed that we would have to come back before the formal consideration of the Revenue Laws Amendment Bills, that there were issues that when we took a briefing, we were informed, when we took our responses from National Treasury, that there were issues that were regarded as outstanding because they still had to be cleared with the executive authority. And that's precisely the reason why we felt that it would be proper to do that today. And if there are any other questions relating to the Revenue Laws Amendment Bills, that we deal with them today, so that when we come to the formal consideration on Wednesday, I would imagine, we are able to spend little time on it instead of going through first outstanding issues, clearing questions of clarity and concern. So we have Mr. Cecil Modell, the man responsible for this, to take us through those outstanding issues, and then I will open it up to committee members for questions and comments, and so that we can put the revenue laws partly behind us until Wednesday when we formally consider them. Mr. Modell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be relatively brief. We've circulated a document which captures some of the issues that we have discussed and raised with the minister. And there are basically four issues that I'll cover, Mr. Chairman. One is the, and all of them were based on the comments that we received on the bill, and it required a bit of a change from the proposal that we've put at the time we released the bill for comments, and therefore it was necessary to get approval for these deviations. The first one is on the retirement, pre-retirement withdrawals from retirement funds. The second one deals with life insurance policies with respect to estate duties. Then there was the proposal to collapse the deemed employee regimes into one. And then lastly, on my list is the provisional payment. On the pre-retirement withdrawal, Mr. Chairman, the amendments we've proposed in the initial draft bill was to simplify the withdrawal. Members would recall that in 2007 we did a simplification of the taxation on retirement. There was then a proposed table and which was approved. Withdrawals pre-retirement was still subject to a formula, and there were some complications in terms of the administration thereof. We then proposed that we will use the current year's tax table with the 50% of the primary rebate as the basis for taxing pre-retirement withdrawals. We had quite a bit of comments on that particular proposal, and one of the concerns we raised is that that regime could actually disadvantage people that were in service for quite a considerable period of time, and specifically people that have worked for longer than 10 years, and then for one or other reasons they lose their job, have to take the money out, and then they are taxed unfairly. We did then looked at the suggestion that was put to us and did a revised calculation, and the revised proposal is that we now want to link it to a, more or less a similar structure to the taxation upon retirement. The table will be slightly different, but the concept would be very similar, and the structure would be very similar. The important thing there is that we don't want to encourage people to take out lump sums, so you don't want to have an incentive regime that is perverse, but you still acknowledge that there needs to be some form of exemption. And we then agreed to an exemption which is not very dissimilar to the previous one of 23,000, that an exemption be 22,500, which we calculate as 7.5% of the exemption upon retirement, or which is 300,000. And then the structure from there onwards, a slight deviation, but very similar to the one upon retirement, that the first 600,000 will be taxed at 18%, barring the exemption of 22,500. The next 300 will be taxed at 27%, and then anything above 900,000 rand will be taxed at 36%. And members can recall these percentages are very similar to the one upon retirement, and the brackets more or less not coincide, but are very similar. We've done a few calculations, and we think this is very reasonable. As a matter of fact, people are slightly better off under this particular regime. And it also provides certainty. It's very simple. It provides certainty, so you don't have to do an average calculation of what was your rate last year or what was the rate this year. Okay. And the Minister is comfortable with that.
Yeah, perhaps let's take one proposal at a time so that we move on with understanding. Are there any questions with regards to pre-retirement withdrawals? Seems to be a move trying to accommodate the concerns that have been raised, and we remember that we actually had been briefed on it, but we didn't have the details. I see there is a slight move from 23 just to 22,500. You say the 22,500 is because you've used the percentage of 7.5%. You want to share with us what informs this? Why is the 7.5%? Why not the 23? Because the 23, had some kind of a bearing on the 50% of the 46,000 in the past. But now it's just 22.5, which is 7.5%. And I have a question from Dr. George as well.
Thanks, Chair. During the course of these deliberations on the laws, somebody raised the issue about implementability of the laws. And my question relates to that, is that we have a cumulative situation here for retirement funds. So the question is, obviously people might move from job to job and make several withdrawals over their lifetime. How will you actually keep track of that? Will that be done by SARS or somewhere else? Thanks, Chair.
Whether withdrawals and transfers are treated the same. Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, look, there was a big debate about whether we should have an exemption or not at all. And I think, having done the sums, I think there is some justification for an exemption. Having moved away from the existing year's structure, which was then linked to the rebate, we have to have another anchor. And the question is, what do you use as an anchor? Because you can have an amount that stands on its own, but with no anchor. And so we thought, let's use the amounts that we've already got for taxation upon retirement as an anchor, and then the closest we can get to a percentage that there wasn't 2 or 5 decimal points was 7.5%. So it was just a rounding off simplification here. We could have used 23%, then it would have worked out to 7.52%, which was just not necessary to do it that way. So that's why it's just a rounding off issue and a simplification one. The implication here is that if we adjusted 300,000 in future, there might be an implicit adjustment in the 22,500, and if you have a 7.5% as a basis, you can easily adjust it. The implementability, SARS already have some record keeping of people withdrawing on a regular basis. So we were informed that SARS have the capacity in order to track it, and they already do it. And it's important because you don't want to have a situation where people take advantage of the lower rate every time and willy-nilly leave their jobs. And so the reason for the accumulative provision is to say to people, next time you withdraw, you're going to be taxed at a higher rate. And I'm given the assurance that that particular ability to track it is in place.
Interesting. And indeed, I would imagine, because whenever there is either a withdrawal or any transaction in retirement, people would have to apply for tax directives from SARS, I would imagine, since you only have one tax number. It shouldn't be. I don't know, but I think that's pretty easy. Mr. Singh.
The effective date of this amendment will still be next tax year, 09-10.
First of March next year. Yeah, that's the effective date.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. Exemption of life insurance from estates.
The next one was a proposal that was intended to encourage savings and make sure people provide for an intergenerational transfer. And it was a proposal that seeks to provide some exemption from estate duty. And the thinking behind it is that if people have a risk insurance premium, and that goes into the estate, why tax it in estate duty? It's a well-intended proposal, and in some quarters it was well-received, but in some quarters we were warned that you're opening here a particular significant avoidance problem, into that people can use their savings in one vehicle and then get it into their estate duty tax-free. And it's very difficult to draw a distinction between a risk element and a savings element of certain insurance products. And therefore, this element of this particular proposal we were drawing, Mr. Chairman, I think the risks are not worth taking it. The issue of pensions going into state duty tax-free, that's still being considered. There's also the accusation or the possibility that this particular proposal will result into discriminating against different forms of saving. Okay. You would encourage people to save in a particular vehicle, get it free of estate duty, and then another form of savings will not qualify for that. So, well, although this was a well-intended proposal, I think the risk associated was just not worth it, and therefore we propose to withdraw it, and the Minister also concurs.
Any questions on that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Yeah, Mr. Maria says that it's going to be withdrawn, but isn't it something that's worth considering for the future? I mean, because here you're just using one hammer for everybody. I mean, there will be a certain section of communities that will really use it as a savings element. And, you know, now you come up with this. I mean, like you said, it was a good proposal. And then all of a sudden we're taking everything away because of the risks. And isn't it something that must be kept on the burner so that must be considered in the future after examining all the risks between now and then?
Mr. Singh, yes, I think one could consider providing further relief. And the most important point here, the relief here is in the form of estate duty. So that's where the relief is targeted. And there are various options that one can look at providing further estate duty relief, and that is something that is still on the agenda. You will recall that a year or two ago, we upped the exemption threshold quite significantly. It was in the order of 1.5 million rand exemption, and it was increased, I think, to 3 million, not 3.5 million, I don't have it with me now. So that was a significant adjustment in providing relief for exemption. If one continue with that line of thinking, the best and most equitable position would probably to lift that threshold further. And that is one thing which I would think is the most appropriate one to do, and I think we should explore that further. Yeah.
Because I think the problem here was that this one was mainly directed at one vehicle, which, with the exclusion of the others, whilst there is a general threshold that covers the rest. Ms. Mokoto.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning. I want to ask one question, because some say that they have the capacity to track and trace whatever that is happening with regard to the the retirement and tracing withdrawal. But, you know, the issue is, you know, I don't know how to put it, but I just want to place it on the table. You'll see how you arrange it.
Ms. Mokoto, is your question related to the first part which we have just dealt with? Or because the first one we dealt with was the pre-retirement withdrawal.
Yes, that's the one.
Oh, because we were now dealing with the second one of the exemption of life insurance. But no, it's okay. But I mean, we can go back. But I just want us to be clear that you are dealing with the first one, not the one that we're with now. Go ahead.
Should I ask the question? Okay, Sam said that they have the capacity to trace the withdrawals, but the issue like that is happening like in real day-to-day life is that people sometimes are not even aware. For instance, even say if you move from one job to another, sometimes you are not aware that you are making a withdrawal because also there is no synchronized way in which, like, if one person moves from one job to the other, there is no synchrony whereby there would be a way in which it's not automatic that the retirement money will be transferred to there because the systems are not synchronized. I want to check, even within government itself, like when you work for local government and automatically have to move into the provincial government, you have two systems in place, except for the tax number. Say, as a public representative, you were a public representative in the local municipality and you become a public representative at national or even at provincial, there is no synchrony as well. I want to check how are you trying to manage that contradiction, because like some of the things that the offenses that can be stated by SARS and that are taxing for other people and costly to them is that they are not aware that they are doing certain things. You will get money and you will think it's something else, only to find that you have broken the laws and the rules. Thank you.
Okay. So what you're saying is that taxpayers themselves may not know that they are transferring or withdrawing, but SARS knows because you only have one tax number. And whenever that transaction happens, a tax directive is sent through to SARS, which comes back to say, if there is a deduction, this is what deduction must be made. But yes, Mr. Mullen. It's a general question, I must say, because here we're just confining ourselves to the pre-retirement withdrawal benefits.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think you've answered the question. I mean, if you change jobs and your jobs have different retirement funds. Like, for example, if you would change jobs within the public sector from one province to another or from province to national, you remain within one fund. That's not a problem because your retirement fund is the same. When you move from one job to another and you've got different retirement funds, like, for example, from local government is not part of the public service. They've got their own retirement fund or any other company. You've got two options there. You've got an option to transfer your funds, your pension fund, to your new employer, or you've got the option to put it in a preservation fund. Or third option, you have the option to take it out and withdraw the money. If you transfer the money to a preservation fund or to a new retirement vehicle, there's no tax implication. There's a tax-free transfer because you keep the money there. But that's your choice as an employee. Between you and the employee, you have to make that particular arrangement. And the default now is that it will go into a transfer rather than a withdrawal, whereas previously the default was that it is assumed to be withdrawn. If you make the choice to withdraw the money, that's where the tax comes in. Okay. And SARS will be able to track it. And as the chair said, whenever a retirement fund make a payment to a person, they have to get a tax director from SARS to know what money they must deduct. Future, it will be very easy for them because there's now just a table they have to use and they tax it on that particular basis. And all they need to know is be able to say what amount did you withdraw previously. So the tax directive will be fairly easy. I hope I've answered your question.
Mr. Fier. I hope we're not going back. We're not going back to one also.
No, because there's a follow up on this one.
Yeah. Oh, you are going back.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's a follow up. Okay. This is very tricky, and I think it when it comes to the point of education and so on. For instance, you work for community-based organization, which doesn't have any funds, just keeping, there's no scheme, whatever, just keeping the money for pensions and so on. When you retire, or when you resign, they give you a lump sum, you just see a lump sum in the bank. You don't know, when you require, that particular community-based organization has just put every money in your account. Yeah, then, therefore, those who understand that I have to transfer it when I leave the job to another job, it's something else you understand. For those who doesn't understand that, then it's a problem. Then that is why I'm saying it's a question of education between the employer and the employee together with SARS. I don't know what they want.
Okay, but I think we must not detract from the point that here the only issue we're dealing with was the pre-retirement withdrawal benefit. I don't, because even if Cecil could educate us, it will still not help the situation out there. But I mean, I think it's an important point that there does seem to be a problem particularly with the employers of not telling people which scheme do you belong to. Is this a provident fund? Is this a retirement benefit? Is this a pension? Some of the provident funds, which are covered by different laws. But here the issue was with the pre-retirement withdrawal benefit, and I think we're satisfied that the concession that has been made more or less addresses the problems raised and the concerns tabled before the committee. Can I request that we proceed to the unification of deemed employee regimes?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The first issue is the issue that deals with employees changing their legal status in order to circumvent pay-as-you-earn. That's basically what this is all about. That you can disguise yourself as a company or some other organization, a trust, and therefore escape pay as you earn, you postpone the liability of tax payment to a later stage, or you actually can reduce your tax liability in certain instances, and you can get certain deductions. There were different rules, there are currently different rules in the Income Tax Act, and the attempt was made to try and consolidate these into one set of rules that applies to an individual, a personal service company, and a trust. And in doing that, the concept of a personal service provider was coined that will consolidate all of these regimes into one, and at the same time it was the issue of a labor broker. However, in trying to do this, you've resulted into unintended consequences that actually will disadvantage certain entrepreneurs. And therefore, Mr. Chairman, the proposal is to revert back and only deal in the case of companies in trust and leave the issue of personal service companies separate. So the proposal is that the personal service provider regime will be modified solely to apply to companies in trust and individuals remaining subject to the pre-existing entity avoidance rules. So it's a very technical issue there that we've tried to consolidate a couple of regimes, and we come to a situation where we don't think this is appropriate. In the case of labor broker regime, it was felt that it is unnecessary to apply to companies in trust because there are already certain regulations that will deal with them, and that will only apply in the case of individuals that are acting as labor brokers together with exemptions. Okay, so that's a bit of a technical issue.
Any questions on the deemed employee regimes, the unification? If not, thanks. We move on to provisional taxes, the second
thing. And the last issue which I'd like to talk to you today is the issue of provisional tax payments. This is largely an admin issue, but it has important cash implications for companies. And currently there are two provisions with respect to provisional payment. Companies have to make two payments, one 6 months in the financial year, the second payment towards the end of the financial year, and the last one 6 months later, which is called a top-up one, in order to ensure reconciliation. The Income Tax Act states two options. One is you have to pay 90% of the final amount due of the year, or 20% the basic amount if a 20% penalty of the is to be avoided. So companies had the option to fall back on what is called a basic amount, which was their tax liability of the last year, or their taxable income of last year. And the problem was that many companies preferred the option of the basic amount because you go a few years ago, once you've assessed, and you use that as a basis. In the meantime, the company is growing, and so they have scored in the sense that for this year they tend to underpay. The proposal was to do away with the basic amount, basically, and say at the second payment, the company must pay at least 90% of what is due. And so that's quite a particular change in the regime by doing completely away with the basic amount. There has been quite a bit of concerns raised by companies in saying this is going to be difficult, they don't know their status, the final tax liability, the end of the financial year, they still have to do their books and so on. And the industry, some industry saying they have to reconcile quite a few issues in order to arrive at it. Having considered that, the proposal is that instead of a 90% mark, SARS has managed over the past few years to improve compliance. There's a provision in the Income Tax Act that will allow them to require companies to pay up if they are of the view that they've underpaid. And if you look at that particular statistics, a lot of companies are actually on their second payment after they have invoked in 19.3 paid up to 80% of what is due. And so the proposal, Mr. Chairman, is to compromise and instead of the 90%, for now settled for 80%. It should be taken note that many countries do have a 90% requirement at the end of the financial year already. And so this is a compromise position which could be reviewed at a later stage, but that is the proposal. There are still some companies that are a bit unhappy with it and say this is going to be pretty onerous, but the feeling is that this should not be too onerous. And there is a letter. The Act do provide that should a company, for reasons beyond its control, have underestimated its liability and the Commission is satisfied that this is really circumstances beyond their control, that the penalty will be waived. So there is some sort of a let out already there.
Okay. Provisional tax. Questions? Comments? Okay. The Commission says if you are happy, we are happy. Mr. Chair,
can I have the opportunity to ask something on the revenue laws amendment bill, except for what we've got in front of we?
That's what I said when we opened, because I said I would want us also to spend time to do that here today, so that on Wednesday it is just a formal consideration. So you're welcome to do that.
Thank you, Chair. I've already spoken to Mr. Morden just before the meeting, and I said to him that there was quite a lot of things that I've sent through that we haven't had response to, especially on things like, you know, the tax laws regarding the disability or disabled. And there was quite strong views on certain issues from the disability fraternity. I haven't got that feedback. So one must now really wait for the version that we will see only on Wednesday, and it's a pity that we haven't got that feedback, because that submission has been done, and that feedback we haven't received to consider. And although, you know, I accept the bona fides of Mr. Morden, it is still something that we must consider seeing it black and white, because then you can really interrogate that, and it's really a pity that we haven't got that. Thank you.
Okay, and I'm not too sure whether the committee also had the advantage of having sight of those submissions, because it helps if the committee has that also, so that it becomes, but it was a submission from a particular sector. And even if it's that is the case, when those submissions are made, they also make them available to the committee, so that the committee members also assist in seeing to it that they are either responded to, not necessarily that they are accommodated, but responded to appropriately. Mr. Mullen?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand correctly, the issues around the deductibility of certain expenses relating to disability. And all the Act, the draft revenue laws amendment will do is to say a list of this nature will be provided. The bill doesn't provide for a list. That will be done by rules within SARS or by way of a regulation. And I think the responsibility would be, and in the response that we gave also, would be the responsibility would be primarily a SARS responsibility to liaise with the various associations to come up with a list or a categories that is in fulfillment of the legislation. And from where we sit as Treasury, we would play a role in that particular process. That's all I can say at this particular stage. Short of trying to spell it out in the Act, which I think is an impossibility, we would hope that Mr. Murray, that particular one, would satisfy you. And as I indicated, I think we should try and set up a meeting as soon as possible between all these players.
Mr. Murray? Are you okay with that?
Now, as I said, Mr. Chair, I mean, I accept the bona fides of Mr. Morden in this regard, and I will most certainly, if I'm invited to a meeting like that, I will most certainly, you know, strive to attend that. But I think it's just the principle of this list, you know, the fact that there's a list, you know, and I think there was a lot of questions about this so-called list and the objectivity of this so-called list. And that in itself, I've seen from the official bodies of disability, being the blind, the physically disabled, the deaf in South Africa, everybody has reacted negatively to that. And the fact that it's still in the bill means that, you know, it's either been ignored, or there's a way that it will be accommodated, and we don't know yet. But we must still accept, you know, we must still consider the bill in front of us.
So I can respond
yeah.
to that.
Maybe let me also just, I mean, so that also as the committee we are also on board. In the bill provides for a list that would list the various disabilities. And according to Mr. Mare, the submissions made by the bodies representing people with disabilities was, I just want to be sure, Mr. Mare, was that there shouldn't be a list. Is that what the submission was saying? That there should not be a list. It should be an open-ended...
I think, you know, Mr. Chair, what the different bodies, as I said, the deaf, the physically disabled and the blind, have said that, you know, who's going to determine a list? My list might be totally different from the next person with a disability. You know, what is justified for me might not be justified for that person. Now, who's going to adjudicate on this list? How will that be done? And they see that when there's a list determined by whom, not by obviously by the affected parties, so it was determined by someone else and will be adjudicated by someone else. And then eventually we know it's going to be a situation between SARS and the taxpayer, which is unnecessary. And they feel that is discriminatory of nature without taking into consideration their really view, practical viewpoint. And not hypothetical, practical issues.
Come on, and also can, from your side, can I also get some clarity here? Is this an amendment that introduces something new that has not been in the Income Tax Act in the past, or...
The proposal of providing for a list was based on previous interaction with players. The feeling was that given the uncertainty and the discretion that was exercised previously, a more objective either list or category would provide a basis for saying we are going to move away from an element of discretion that probably was there to a more sort of objective criteria. Our interaction with some of the players was that they are amenable to that. The question was just in compiling that particular list, there needs to be consultation. And that's the process, I think, Mr. Chair, that we will have to go through. And we'll have to give it a try, and if it doesn't work, we'll have to amend it. I mean, this is the unfortunate thing within the income, with the tax legislation that we can experiment and then see what.
But does then the bill specify that there will be consultation in the compilation of the list? Okay. If I would imagine it accommodates Mr. Mare's point, because it's not a total objection, but it is saying nothing about people with disabilities without them. The list would actually, the process would have to be an all-inclusive process that includes the player. Okay. So it's the determination of the list, Mr. Mare, and I think you're happy that there will be a consultation process, and it is also provided for in the law. There will be consultation. Okay. Any other questions with regards to the Revenue Laws Amendment Bills? Mr. Asia?
No, Chair, it's not within. What I wanted to raise, though, when you finish, is around your opening remarks. I want to make a personal proposal in some of them, in one of them.
You're welcome to do so. As it relates to the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. Okay, because if not, I would love to release Mr. Modern. okay. You know,
Can I recommend that we just... Mr. Madan, thank you very much. We will then await for these proposals to be incorporated in the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, which we will formally consider on the 22nd. Mr. Singh.
Yeah, Chair, thank you. There's a document to RLA B4C from PricewaterhouseCoopers. I think this is a new document, dated 23rd, where probably the committee needs to consider whether they get another bite at the cherry after the explanation.
No, Mr. Singh. I think it was very mischievous of PwC to release that document after we had, because PwC actually had an opportunity. And I would imagine, I think there's this committee. One of the things that is being tested here is what we originally had said we would have to deal with at a later stage. I don't know whether within this parliament session, looking at the time, but what we said was that perhaps in our processes, one of the things that do not happen is an opportunity for the committee to, after these engagements between the committee, we take a briefing from the department, we take submissions and there are responses, for the committee to find time also to engage with the stakeholders just so as to check. And we had said that we would have to look into that in the future. So it would be unfair for the others that had made submissions, exactly like PwC, that PwC gets an opportunity for us to again engage with them even after we had closed the matter. And these matters will keep on coming up, and I would imagine PwC is here to stay. We're not going to be, I didn't hear of any relationship between them and Lehman Brothers. So I trust that they will be around for a long time to come, and Parliament will always be open to them. So I don't think, I mean, unless the committee feels that we should reverse the process, but that's what we had said. Mr. Madan, you are free to leave. Thank you. Mr. Afia, because the next item now, we're going to have a quick look at the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Bill, which the committee has adopted. But I just wanted to raise a small point with the committee, which I would want the committee to consider, and it's up to the committee how we proceed from here. Mr. Afia.
Chair, the point I wanted, or the request I wanted to make in your opening remarks was, maybe jokingly or not, and now it's not in relation to political parties, it's relating what is happening in the world market, which I find it is very interesting and important for me and this committee. I don't know at what time where we'll be getting the department, even the minister, have to come and brief this committee, so that on Wednesday we'll have a meeting. If your good office and yourselves can squeeze their hands and begin to... I'm not tying up a date, but I'm saying that whilst the fever is going on, or the sneezing, no, it's not sneezing, it's fever, before it becomes a Congo fever or whatever, we have to be aware as South Africans and this community. I think it will be of the paramount importance, the Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Asi. I think that's very important. I know in the section that touches on the international outlook, there will be something also in the MTPPS. But I would imagine ourselves as the committee, as you have indicated, that the department, the National Treasury, reports to us on these matters, would need to be given an opportunity for a direct discussion on these issues. Secondly, the problem in the global economy we have here has to do with the financial markets and the failure of prudential financial regulation. That's blatant. It comes across. It's clear. And if you listen to them talking about these things, when they say they were over innovative in coming up with some of those things, and it's about the financial markets having been innovative
and it has landed the world economy to where it is today. And besides the contagion from the larger economies or the developed economies, like you said, that jokingly I said, you are either you can only be insulated if you are isolated, and unfortunately we are not isolated. So it would be useful for us to, one, to get the banking supervision division from the Reserve Bank to assure us, how safe we are from this, being also machinized from within, and also the Financial Services Board that regulate the financial services sector, as to, we've seen some of the cases of the things that have happened within our own economy. The Fidentia cases are but some of those, the backing stories that we have dealt with in the past, that this over-innovation at times has a tendency of undermining the stability of the financial industry. So it would really be important that at some point we get our regulators also to appear before us, just to assure us so that we can assure the nation whether we're doing everything to make sure that what has happened outside doesn't happen inside. So I'd imagine we'll look into that, and the committee would be keen to know about those things. Thank you. Thanks. Where is Mr. Jenkins? Mr. Jenkins, you would recall that, can't you sit more to the front? Have you circulated the money amendment, the money bills amendment procedure and related matters bill? Have members got the bill? Because I just want to raise an issue that at some point when I was cornered, honourable members, by people commenting on the bill, I had a completely different understanding, and I was a bit embarrassed to find that my understanding is not what is in the bill. It's an issue in Section 10.5A. 5 says, another committee may advise a committee on appropriations that a subdivision of a main division within a vote be appropriated conditionally to ensure that the money requested for the main division will be spent effectively, efficiently, and economically, provided that no more than 10% of the funds appropriated for a main division within a vote, excluding projected personnel costs, may be appropriated conditionally. I can't remember when in our discussions I'm not too sure whether 10% really, because my question, I remember when I was asking Advocate Jenkins and Alta whether it's the percentage or the extent to which this will be useful. Because when you say 10%, what if the amount in question exceeds 10%? I just wanted to hear the views of the committee because my understanding was that we did not have a percentage here, and want to appeal to the committee that we apply our minds such that we do not leave a constraint that otherwise would render the bill ineffective when it comes to its implementation. Mr. Mulondo.
As far as I recall during our discussion, the rationale in having the clause, with hindsight, I would agree with you that it might have some implication. The rationale was that if, for instance, let's use a department like Home Affairs, you say we can conditionally appropriate 50% of the money, then it can paralyze the department in a way. But I think I do agree with, with hindsight, I would say Parliament would exercise its powers responsibly, and would have to be given good reasons, or it has to give good reasons why it has to go beyond 10%. Because the issue of a figure, it's limiting, and it has major complications. If the amount that let's say Parliament feels strongly that they want to limit that amount, and there are good reasons why they have to limit that amount, appropriate that amount conditionally, but that amount is 10, more than 10%, then you can't touch it. you can't do anything about it. But if you then remove, I would suppose that maybe what you do is just remove the whole of A, unless there are other legal implications of doing that. But remove the whole of A and then trust that Parliament in exercising its mandate will do so responsibly, and that it helps to engage with departments and come to sort of an agreement. Because the issue here is that also you don't want to reach a stage where you have appropriate conditionally and people don't get paid. Salaries are not paid because you said, no, freeze the money. Because this is I think as far as I know, it's a freeze. You say freeze the money and people are not able to pay for their contracts, for their personnel, all those type of things. But I would say we can remove it, but as long as Parliament, when it comes to that point of freezing the money, they should show good reason why they are doing that and the implications of that decision. Because I would assume why they were saying excluding projected personal costs. Part of it is to avoid that situation where civil servants are not paid because we have gone for a freeze. So, yes, there might be, there might be contracts that people have gone into 2 years ago or whatever. They might be rolling contracts, but you have frozen the money and then the contract there cannot be honored. But I'm saying, look, the issue of 10% can be a bit problematic if Parliament has got good reason to freeze 5 million and only to find that it's 5 million and 200,000. And you can't do anything about it because the amount has exceeded by 200,000 or by 50 rand or whatever. I'm just giving you an example. So I would say remove it, but I trust that Parliament, you know, whatever it does, it can't just do things arbitrarily. It has to explain its position on each and everything.
Let's hear other views before I get the advocate to respond. Mr. Singh.
Yeah, Chair, thank you. You know, I can't recall us taking a firm decision on a percentage. I know there were discussions around vironments and what DGs are allowed to do in terms of the PFMA and things like that. But I know it did come from Advocate Alta. We were talking about a threshold and a percentage. But I can't recall us having really tied ourselves down to a 10%, unless Advocate Jenkins can refresh our memory.
Any other view, Dr. Church?
We'd support removal of that subclause.
Thanks. Advocate Jenkins?
Good morning, Honourable Chair and members. Thank you. I would also say that the issue of the 10%, was not ventilated to the same extent as other provisions of this bill in the discussions. It did come out during the end process when the issue of the conditional freeze was put in. The purpose of it has been highlighted by Mr. Malotto, and I think in light of Clause 8.5, which sets out what used to be the specific fiscal responsibility clause, which is now just built into Clause 8, subclause 5, which is the issue of responsibly exercising the powers to amend money bill, one can actually see that 10% might be more problematic than useful in the end. So I think the issue of then is hard to remove it if the committee wants to take that decision.
Yeah, perhaps your advice is also going to be useful in terms of how to remove it. The bill has been written and the bill has been passed by the committee, but it's this committee that also feels that we're unhappy with the particular clause and would want to table an amendment to the bill. If you could advise us in terms of parliamentary procedures so that we follow that procedure, because there is agreement that we should remove it. Mr. Mlatu.
I don't know the procedures, but I see these parties in parliament, Mr. Jenkins can help us, where you find that there's a bill that's being passed in the House, but there is there's a tabling of an amendment, a small one pager, maybe one line. I've seen that together with the bill.
Yeah.
Is that not feasible?
You've read,
Mr. Filion is referring me to 254, amendments proposed by members before decision of second reading. 2541A says, after a bill has been placed on the order paper for second reading, but before the Assembly decides on the second reading, a member may place amendments to the clauses of the bill on the order paper. The bill that has been rejected by the committee, which is not something else, but shouldn't that be the approach?
Yes, Chair. I would say that is the approach. What happens in practice with a bill that's been proposed by a committee is the best example would be the Powers and Privileges Bill of 2004. So because a committee, portfolio committee, has dealt with it already, the first and second readings basically happens on the same day. Most of the time, doesn't get referred formally back to the committee. So this committee will not, if that practice is followed, will not get the time to adopt the report suggesting the removal of 10 sub 5, is it? 10 sub 5A. So the idea would be then rather to propose an amendment from the floor, and the issue would be if, I think it's Thursday, the first and second reading debate on this bill. Well, the first reading is, I don't know about the second, as I say, on Wednesday. Then one will have to look at specifically then to get the amendment on the order paper today by just suggesting that we, if I understand the committee correctly, and I would support that, to remove sub A, 5A, and just to get that done so that that order can be dealt with immediately after the first reading debate, before the second reading debate. I would suggest that, and I mean, I can, Bradley and I can liaise with Mr. Mansoura and Mr. Masibule Lepaso to get this done properly, because they are the custodians of procedure.
Okay. Can we then request that you do that on behalf of the committee, and so that we are able to do that and then prepare a proper statement of amendment? Okay. When Advocate Jenkins says Thursday, Mr. Marais says Wednesday, I'm sitting here also with the confusion. I want Mr. Fuzu to clarify this thing. I think it's on Thursday. It's been changed to Thursday. So it is Thursday. Okay. Can we, leave this in your capable hands to follow up. And thanks, honourable members, for... Thank you, and thanks, Mr. Thanks, Advocate Jenkins. You are relieved. Mr. Filion is circulating our program for this week, and
what's the finance bill? Which one did we label as finance bill?
The finance bill, members, is a bill. It is actually the resolutions of SCOPA where Parliament has to adopt, which authorizes, which otherwise had been annexed. Yeah. It's a beautiful rubber stamping piece of legislation. Yeah, no, that's what it's called. You know, in fact, because they accumulate all the resolutions of those ratified, authorize unauthorized expenditure, which has gone through the parliamentary processes, SCOPA, and then it comes to us as the finance bill. The ESCOM bill, members, we are going to be briefed on the ESCOM bill by National Treasury when they appear before us on the MTVPS. As you can see, that the day, the 22nd, it's going to be quite a day. I'm informed that the ESCOM bill is a bill that actually answers the questions that members kept on asking. Is this a loan? Because there is this thing which says this injection, is this a grant? Is this a loan? I'm informed that it has to be allocated in terms of a certain piece of legislation that sets out all the modalities. I haven't had sight of it, but I'm informed we will be briefed on it, and it's this committee that will have to apply its mind on that bill. and it's a money bill. It will be tabled before powers, before Parliament has powers to amend. yeah. Any other questions? That's the program, members, as it stands now. We have Friday. We have tomorrow, which has the lock-up session, the medium-term budget policy statement in the afternoon, and then on Wednesday we will deal with that long list of issues. And then on the 23rd, it will be the debates. All the debates have been moved to the 23rd. And then on Friday, we'll have hearings on the MTBPS, where we'll only have a panel of economists and civil society for those that have confirmed. And after that, we will proceed, if the committee has identified any of the adjustments that might require hearings. So the 28th entirely depends on this committee. If this committee feels that they would want to deal with the 28th and the 29th, is entirely in your hands. And then on the 4th, we would have to consider that. Because we do not want to close the doors. If the committee feels that some of the adjustments might need departments appearing before us to explain themselves when we adjust their appropriations. But the adjustments will be tabled to the
debating it on Thursday.
The adjustments of appropriation, is it coming up for debate on Thursday?
Second reading debate, yeah. Or no debate?
No, there is no debate. Yeah. It's actually us that would have to say we would want to have the hearings. If we want to have those hearings, then the debate would have to be set after we have had hearings. So when we deal with these on the 22nd, that's when the committee would actually have to make that that call. Okay, members, there will be lunch. But you've also committed a crime, which means you have to be detained here until lunch because you finished earlier. but there will be lunch. We have requested that it be brought up as soon as possible. I don't know how soon. Amanda, what does as soon as possible mean? Okay. But there will be lunch. If members could just avail themselves for lunch. I've also circulated an invitation from the BOSA on the medium-term budget policy statement. They say they have a review function on the 23rd of October. That's Thursday. The venue is Weber Wenza, 15th floor, Convention Tower, Herengracht, Foreshore, Cape Town. It starts at, I've circulated the invitation there. It's attached there. In that date is 23rd, time 7:30 to 8 is breakfast, to 10, yeah. Is it not attached? Bradley, how can you? It is attached on mine, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No. My apologies. Okay, that then brings us to the end of the session and the meeting for today. We will meet tomorrow again, and the venue for tomorrow is E249, as usual for the MTBPS. We arrive at 10, and can I request that members strictly adhere to the lock-up rules? It's an interesting thing because You get the lock-up rules for members of parliament, and the media is locked up somewhere. But people are beginning to write about the MTBPS already. Okay. Unless it's, I mean, it's just coincidence. They're just too accurate because they're very good at. Good day, ladies and gentlemen. We'll meet tomorrow again. Oh, no, we meet for lunch.